Chapter 13. Turkish Cigarettes on Gosling Lane. Gosling Lane did not live up to the rustic promise of its name. With not a goose to be seen, it was a short, narrow thoroughfare north of Oxford Street, and occupied by thin houses, many converted into sweatshops producing cheap shirts to be sold in the nearby bazaars. And I had hardly set foot on the befouled pavement before Sidney Grice tipped his head back, "Drive on!" I was glad that he did not think the man sharpening a carving knife on the curbstone presented a threat, but I could not help remembering how George Pound was stabbed once, and I was relieved when the door opened a crack.
"I wish you,"
Mrs. Frevel said, and I resisted retorting, as Mr. G might have, that I was already aware of that. I could sympathise with Mrs. Frevel's annoyance, for none of her tenants ever responded to visitors. She lived on the ground floor alone, but for a balding mongrel called Turndap, because, she once told me, he just turned up on her doorstep. "I'm sorry to disturb you." Turndap poked his speckled nose through the gap, sniffing eagerly, and I rummaged for threepence in my purse.
"I ain't a bleeding doorman."
She pulled back, affronted. I leaned over to scratch behind the dog's ear, and his back leg paddled the air. "A present for Turndap." Turndap drooled blissfully onto my hem.
"It could do with a new cap," Mrs. Frevel conceded. "The other dogs laugh at his old one."
A black dot landed on the back of my hand, but then, I was relieved to see, jumped straight back to rejoin its friends in the greasy coconut matting that served Turndap as fur. I dropped the coin into an outstretched apron. Mrs. Frevel never touched money, being convinced that the wren on a farthing had given her glangular fever 20 years ago. And Turndap slumped mournfully as I mounted the stairs. Geraldine Hockaday and her brother Peter lived in the three-roomed attic of number 8. By local standards, this was luxurious. The four lower floors were divided into single rooms, some of which housed entire families, and one old woman appeared to have set up home on the lower landing. She was sprawled out, slurping from a jam jar, and dribbling some torp coagulum down herself. I stepped carefully over her rag-bound feet. Geraldine was knitting when I went to see her, a tiny pink sock suspended from her needles like a cocoon. She loved to make baby clothes, and lay them between sheets of tissue paper in a pine chest at the foot of her bed. We blew kisses in greeting, her lips puckering like a child trying to whistle. The small sitting room was simply furnished with a plain wooden dining table on one side, and two sagging armchairs facing a bricked-up fireplace on the other. Alongside the only possible source of heating permanently blocked, the floor gave little comfort, with draughts rising between the bare boards. I dreaded to think how cold that apartment would be in the winter.
"I am well," she responded to my inquiry, and she looked healthy enough, though pale from being housebound. But Geraldine's bush baby eyes flicked about, looking everywhere for the attack she constantly anticipated.
"How did it go?"
she asked the moment I sat opposite her. I drew a breath, for I knew that Geraldine had high hopes that something would come of our meeting with Johnny Wallace. I am sorry to say that our witness was murdered before he could tell us anything. Geraldine had a pointy pink nose and a pointy chin to match. She was a slight girl. I have often been described as scrawny, but being near her made me feel huge and ungainly.
"But how?"
She mouthed the words in shock before she uttered them, and I wished I could have sat beside her and taken her hand, but she disliked being touched by anybody. I had seen her inarticulate with terror when Peter had accidentally bumped into her once. "He was shot, but his killer got away." I wished I could have told her something else, but I could not break a confidence by mentioning Lucy. Geraldine went back to her knitting while she digested the news.
"I cannot pretend to feel sorry for Mr. Wallace," she decided,
a whiteness floating to the surface of her cheeks.
for it was he who directed me down that alley."
She shuddered as if being plunged through broken ice on a pond,
"and blocked my escape. But he was the only one who knew."
"We have not given up," I vowed, but Geraldine did not seem to be listening. "Mr. Grice will think of something," I tried, all too aware of how hollow my assurance sounded. The discs grew until her face was alabaster, but still there was no response.
"He always does," I said helplessly. "I learned a new stitch yesterday," she announced,
and the needles whirled and clicked in a series of complicated manoeuvres, tucking her wool through and around itself.
"See?"
She held her handiwork up for inspection.
"Lovely,"
I said, though one stitch looked much like another to me. Geraldine put her knitting in her lap with the exaggerated care of somebody who is not really aware of what they are doing.
"Peter pawned his inheritance to pay Mr. Grice's fees, everything he had and ever expects to have."
I watched the ball of wool fall off her knee and down her dress.
"I know, and I am sorry."
The ball rolled over the floor to come to rest at my feet.
"If you would like us to give up this case, I will get Mr. Grice to reimburse you."
I knew that Sidney Grice would not consider paying her back. In his mind, the case was still open, and he did not like admitting defeat. But I was quite willing to refund his charges. It was difficult to pretend that we had achieved anything.
"Is that what you want?"
Geraldine jumped, as if I had sprung at her.
"To desert me?"
"No, I want to catch the man who did this to you." Her nose crinkled like an inquisitive mouse.
"This?"
she repeated uncertainly, as if I meant the room. Geraldine picked up her needles and the sock fell off one of them. "I hope it does not unravel." I stooped to retrieve the ball.
"It is all unraveled,"
she said simply.